G'day, Ross. How are you this week, mate?
I'm fine, thank you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Let's start with listener questions, as we seem to always do now, Ross. This comes from Cherie. She said, could you please ask Dr. Ross Walker what would be the best treatment for thinning of the skin? Her husband is in his mid-70s and is constantly tearing his skin on the slightest object. She said he is an insulin-dependent type 2 diabetic, so we've had a few scares with lower leg lacerations. And being an active person, this is getting him down a bit.
Firstly, can I just make a correction there? He's not an insulin-dependent type 2 diabetic. That's actually an oxymoron. He's a type 2 diabetic who now requires insulin. Now, why there's a distinction there is a type 1 diabetic is somebody who needs insulin from the start, and they have a total lack of insulin in their pancreas. That's why they're a type 1 diabetic, and that's why they need insulin therapy from the start. But some type 2 diabetics, and not a small proportion, after a while their pancreas doesn't work that well, so they also need to be on insulin. But they call them insulin-requiring type 2 diabetics because they still need all the other treatments for type 2 diabetes, which don't really work in the type 1 diabetic. So it's just important to get the terminology right, and I'm a bit of a pedant in all of this. So he's not an insulin-dependent type 2 diabetic. That's the wrong terminology. Now, unfortunately, that's the only good news I've got for today. The bad news is that when people get to a certain age, especially if they've had a long-term chronic illnesses, something like diabetes, the skin gets friable. And apart from avoiding a lot of blood thinners, which many people need to be on, there's not a huge amount that you can do for it. There's no major skin rejuvenation treatments apart from all the things you hear about the wrinkle treatments that people offer. I mean, there's some things like vitamin E cream you can rub on the skin, but whether that's going to give him better skin or not, it's really the problem with diabetes is they have a problem not just with the macro circulation, so the big blood vessels going to the brain and the heart and the legs, but also the microcirculation, which is where this becomes a problem, where the microcirculation becomes defective. So as I said, the only thing really is the vitamin E cream and possibly the combination of natural vitamin E, which is D-alpha tocopherol, or the tocotrienols, which are the best new version of vitamin E, taken with vitamin C. So 500 to 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day may give him some repair in his blood vessels, but I'm not being particularly optimistic here.
We've talked about type 2 diabetes many times, and I've asked you before, are you able to get over type 2 diabetes with losing weight, changing diet? If you are taking insulin, are you able to get over type 2 diabetes or not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really just depends on how much the pancreas has failed. So let me make the point that type 2 diabetes is typically in 95 to 98% of cases caused by the gene insulin resistance. And the insulin resistant gene occurs in 30% of Caucasians, 50% of Asians, and close to 100% of people with darker or olive skin. They're born with that gene, but then the gene loads the gun, then the environment pulls the trigger, i.e. they get exposed to Western crap, which is excessive nutrition and also in being sedentary and all of that sort of stuff. So too much food and not enough exercise. And so then they get fat around the belly, the pancreas starts to fail, they're not getting enough sugar into the cells because they're insulin resistant, their blood pressure goes up, their triglyceride goes up, down goes their HDL. And the best treatment for all of these people is to lose weight. So I say often, if my patients lost somewhere between 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 kilos, depending on how much they need to lose, I'd be twiddling my thumbs all day, because the true pandemic of the 21st century is diabetes. But if people do lose that weight and take the bergamot products I talk about, and there's a drug called metformin, all of these things may take them from being diabetic back to pre-diabetic and sometimes even non-diabetic. So how do you make that diagnosis? Well, first let me make the point, please don't have a glucose tolerance test. That's 2 hours of your life you'll never get back. When you go in fasted to a pathology department, they do an overnight fasting sugar level, then they give you 75 grams of this horrible tasting sweet stuff, and then measure your sugar on a couple more occasions over the next couple of hours. It tells you nothing more than just having an overnight fasting sugar and hemoglobin A1C, which is 3 months sugar control. And let me make the point that if your sugar is less than 5, that is completely normal, fasting sugar level. If your hemoglobin A1C is less than 5, then you are completely and utterly non-diabetic. If you're between 5 to 6 blood sugar level, that's borderline high. Hemoglobin A1C from 5 to 5.5 is still normal, but it's getting towards pre-diabetes. But 5.5 to 6.5 hemoglobin A1C is pre-diabetic. Blood sugar level 6 to 7.5, pre-diabetic. Above 7.5 blood sugar level is diabetic. Above 6.5 HbA1c is diabetic. That's all you need to know to make the diagnosis. And you can shift yourself back towards normal by losing the weight, taking the Bergamot products, the BJA100, and maybe taking metformin. But the major key is losing that belly fat. And for males, you want your waist circumference to be well below 95 centimetres. For females, well below 80 centimetres.
Another question from Madge. Madge says, I think we may have talked about this before, Ross, but I'll ask it anyway, because repetition is the mother of skill.
Of course.
Madge says, is it best to take magnesium at night before bed?
Oh, yeah, it's fine to do that. It really depends on what are you taking magnesium for. So some people find magnesium does assist in their sleep, other people not at all. Some people get cramping at night, restless leg syndrome. And so if that's the case, take the magnesium before you go to bed. That's a good thing to do. And look, I take a magnesium twice a day, one in the morning, one at night. That gives me no sedative properties whatsoever, but I just keep it because it's good for the muscles. And the magnesium I take has magnesium orotate and aspartate in it, which has some extra benefits improving the energy in the cells. But nighttime's fine.
Murray says, if I take that multivitamin that Dr. Ross talked about and you sent me the info on, do I still need to take the folic acid Dr. Ross talks about as well?
No, because it's all in the multivitamin, but it has to be the multivitamin that contains the fourth generation folic acid. And as you know, you and I both cannot say that on air.
Last but not least today from Arnold. Is being able to hold your breath for 60 seconds a good indication of healthy lung capacity, and is healthy lung capacity linked to healthy lungs?
Yeah, to an extent, Arnold's right, but it's so variable. Some people just can't hold their breath for more than 30 seconds, but being able to hold your breath for a good 90 seconds, it's not a bad thing to do, and in fact, I say to a lot of my patients that have chronic lung disease or chronic asthma, it's important not only to do normal exercise, but it's also important to do lung exercises. And one of the good simple lung exercises, you take a deep breath in, hold it for 4 seconds, 5 seconds, and then take a deep breath out. And then there's pursed lip breathing, where you breathe in and you breathe out against your lips closed. So you go shh as you're breathing out there. And then there's opera singing breathing, which is why the opera singers can really push out a tune or push out a note for so long, because basically what they do is diaphragmatic breathing. So you put your hand on your belly and you breathe in without moving your chest, and your tummy goes outwards because the diaphragm is pushing the abdominal contents down. And you do that, you hold your breath in for as long as you can, and then you breathe out through that, and it gives you much better lung capacity, opens up the bases of the lungs. But just holding your breath is a good thing to do as well. And there's a thing called the Buteyko breath method, which is very good for people with chronic lung disease and asthma. And so it's something you just go online, you look up Buteyko, and that's part of that is holding your breath as well. So there's a lot of things you can do. And yes, Arnold's right. It is good for your lung capacity. It is a good indication that you've got a good lung capacity, because people with chronic lung disease really can't hold their breath for too long at all.
If you've smoked, but you haven't smoked for 30 plus years, are your lungs still affected because you smoked?
Yeah. Look, any time you've had any damage to the lungs, there is always some residual damage left. And as you get older, your lung capacity drops off as well, as does your kidney capacity, your cardiac capacity. So everything changes as you get older. But you still can repair some damage. There is never a time in your life where you will not benefit from stopping smoking. And it's not just the effects it has on your lungs, it's the effects it has on your vascular system as well. Because every time you smoke, your blood gets thicker. There are 500 poisons in cigarettes, 50 poisons at least, probably more, and that they can cause all sorts of things from lung damage, vascular damage, cancers, a whole lot of that. But you'll always get some recovery in your lungs, but you won't go from say, if you've got 30, 40% damage back to 2% or 3%, but you might go back from 30, 40% to 20, 30%. And here's the problem with smoking or any other trouble in your organs, that there's such reserve that, for example, if you're a healthy person and you lose one lung, you're not going to get short of breath because the other lung will take over. But if you've been smoking, when you start getting short of breath as a consequence of the smoking, you've typically lost about 70 to 80% of your lung function. So as I said, if you stop, you might get 10 to 20% of that back, but you're not going to go back to normal.
Let's do some of those topics, Ross. Firstly, there's a new study, and it shows that billions worldwide consume inadequate levels of micronutrients critical to human health.
Well, see, this is the interesting thing, that this study out of the Lancet Global Health has said that half the global population consumes inadequate levels of several micronutrients. So that's probably about 4 billion people aren't getting vitamins, minerals, and trace metals. And they looked at some of the common vitamins and minerals involved here: calcium, iodine, iron, riboflavin, which is B2, folic acid or folate, which is B9, zinc, magnesium, selenium, thiamin B1, niacin B3, and vitamins A, B6, B12, C, and E. That's a hell of a lot of micronutrients we're not getting a lot of here. And they're saying that, for example, iodine is probably the worst. 68% of the global population are deficient in iodine, which is so important, especially for thyroid metabolism. 67% vitamin E, 66% calcium, 65% iron. Inadequate levels for about 50% riboflavin, folate. Anyhow, I go on with all this stuff. But what I'm saying is that when you hear doctors say, you don't need to take supplements because you get all the nutrients from your food, well, I tell you what, it ain't happening. And less than 10% of people have two or three pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day, which is, to me, the minimum intake we should have of fruits and vegetables, which is where we get most of our vitamins, minerals, and trace metals from. So I think that these days we should be really focusing on the fruit and vegetable intake, but also I think it's good to take a high-quality multivitamin that you and I were just talking about then.
Ross, as you get older, is your digestive system not able to process the vitamins and minerals from food? So therefore, you need to take these vitamins and mineral supplements.
That's a great point. And it's not just the fact that the gastrointestinal system itself doesn't digest the vitamins and minerals and trace metals, but our gut microbiome changes and typically becomes more defective and less diverse. And the gut microbiome is vital in the generation of a whole lot of different vitamins, minerals, and trace metals. So when you eat food, the gut processes that food, the microbiome processes the food, and then distributes the appropriate vitamins, minerals, trace metals into your system. So as we get older and everything changes, things just don't get absorbed properly. We get more leaky gut, so that instead of having very tight gut junctions, the gut junctions get broken down and the cells break down. The little linings of the cells called villi don't work as well. A whole lot of things go wrong.
Let's talk about this new device that monitors levels of inflammation associated with C-reactive protein in real time. What's that all about, Ross?
See, this is the thing. We were designed, as I've said to you on numerous occasions, to live for 30, 40 years wandering around a jungle with a spear. So we were really only designed, our physiology was designed as hunter-gatherers. And what did hunter-gatherers die from? Infection or from trauma. They didn't have these chronic diseases that we had. So basically, our immune system is only geared for trauma or acute inflammation. But what happens when you get beyond your use-by date, which is about 40, so you hit 50, the hormones go south, things start to wear out pretty quickly. So certain proportion of the population, a lot of people, get fat built up in the lining of their arteries. Certain people, their cells turn cancerous. Certain people get Alzheimer's disease. And so what happens, a big proportion of that is a chronic inflammatory reaction to things breaking down in the body, and then the chronic inflammation becomes part of the problem. Now, up to now, we've had this test called highly sensitive C-reactive protein, which is a good indication of the general inflammatory response in your body. So you can go off to your pathology test department right now and have a blood test for HSCRP, highly sensitive C-reactive protein, And if you're HSCRP when you're feeling fine, not when you've just had a chest infection or you've just got acute arthritis in your knee, but when you're feeling fine, if your CRP is below 1.5, then your immune system is buzzing. So I've had a few respiratory tract infections this year, but I had my blood test done a couple of weeks ago and I had a CRP done and my CRP was 0.43, telling me that my immune system is very healthy and working well. But you've got to go off and have a blood test done for that. And we're talking now the potential to measure real-time CRP like we measure real-time sugar with those Libre freestyle sugar monitors. A lot of people have this continuous glucose monitoring. They just put a little patch on their arm and they can put their phone over the patch and it tells them exactly what their sugar is. Well, they're talking about now the potential for being able to do this at some stage in the near future. We're looking at HSCRP, so you can just look and see what your inflammatory status is. And I think what's happening now, we're already seeing this with a lot of these mobile phones, the smartphones and the smart watches people wear, that there's a lot of self-monitoring going on anyhow for things like pulse rate and ECGs and oxygen levels. And we're getting towards being able to have these little monitors you can put on the skin, maybe just even from your watch that'll measure your sugar and your CRP. So just give you all of these health parameters that tell you how your body's traveling at the time. And look, I think there's the fine line between what I call health anxiety and just being sensible about screening. And there are some people who suffer severe health anxiety and they come into my practice and they've got a folder full of all of their blood tests and all the tests they've had and it's all ordered and very, very much. And they're so focused on monitoring every aspect of their health. And you know what, mate? If you practice health anxiety, there's a 30% increased risk for heart disease just by doing that. So so really, I say to people, smell the roses, don't analyse the damn thing.
Quick question from that, though. A healthy immune system, it doesn't mean you won't get sick, does it?
No. It means that you're just not that sick at the moment. But I'll give you an example. Normal CRP is less than 5. The ideal one is less than 1.5. But I've seen people in the throes of acute influenza go up to 250. I've seen one person with COVID, very severe COVID, 350. People with what we call polymyalgia rheumatica, which is an autoimmune disease, around 100. Leukemia, 150. Acute pneumonia, 200. So, and if you had just a bit of a sore throat, your CRP might be 10. So no, it just tells you where you are right at the moment, which is why they're talking about doing it in real time rather than just having a blood test every 6 months, which only tells you what your immune system is doing right at the moment of the blood test.
We've talked about type 2 diabetes already today with Cherie's question about her husband.
Yep.
Scientists have found that gut health plays a major role in managing type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, and see, this is the point why I want to bring this up. We're just seeing that gut health is really linked to well over 90% of modern diseases. And now they're saying that there's a strong link between what's happening in your gut microbiome and type 2 diabetes, a bit what we were saying before about how the gut microbiome is also involved intricately in what food you absorb and what vitamins you absorb. But they're saying that as a type 2 diabetic gets more into their disease, then their gut microbiome can change, but even a defective gut microbiome can contribute to the disease as well. So this article basically was just a review looking at the link between the two conditions. And why is it important? Because firstly, they're talking about being able to use personalised treatment plans and dietary recommendations based on what bacteria you're finding in someone's gut microbiome. And they're even saying potentially a fecal microbiome transplant to restore healthy gut metabolism and microbiota in the people with type 2 diabetes. But also you can change the microbiome itself by looking at how the medications interact with people and also diagnostic tools just to analyze the disease progression. So basically we're just saying really there's a strong link between the two things. And this is another thing for the future, my friend. And I don't want to get too neurotic about this, but they're even talking about potentially smart toilets that will analyze your microbiome every time you open your bowels, and you'll get feedback as to how your gut microbiome is working. Because if you think about it, if you have to go off and donate a bit of stool to a pathology company for them to analyze your stool, all they're doing is telling you what it's like in that particular stool sample. And it's a bit like what I was saying about the CRP. You want to know what all these things are doing in real time. But again, how much do you want to know about this? I just don't think we should be getting too neurotic.
It puts a new slant on what you just said about smelling the roses.
Yeah, that's right, smelling the roses. Oh, very good.
All right, a new kind of vaccine could lead to the eradication of Alzheimer's.
Isn't this extraordinary? When you look at what's happened up to this point, a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to be screened for Alzheimer's disease because I just don't want to know that I'm sitting on that time bomb, the ticking time bomb that could kill me and whatever. But I think this is now we get moving into the era of not just treatments for Alzheimer's, and there are some modestly effective treatments on the market at the moment. There's some monoclonal antibodies that have been tested over the last 5 or 6 years that have shown some benefit, but also some side effects. This company called Vaccinity, great name, reckon that they may have an Alzheimer's vaccine on the market by 2030. Now, what does it actually do? Because when we think of vaccines, we think of vaccines against infection. And we did speak a few weeks ago about some of the studies are showing that people have regular flu vaccines, people have vaccines against shingles, and vaccines against all the common infections have less Alzheimer's disease, and they're even more effective than the current treatments we're suggesting for Alzheimer's disease. But here's the deal. What's actually causing Alzheimer's disease is the accumulation of these two types of protein. One is a thing called amyloid protein, which accumulates outside the neurons, and the other, these things called tau tangles, T-A-U, tau tangles that accumulates inside the neurons. And so the first thing that happens is probably the amyloid protein's going outside, but then the tau tangles get inside the neurons, and then you're really getting towards advanced Alzheimer's disease. So these vaccines are now basically vaccinating you against these two different types of proteins. And they've tested them in experimental animals, showing that it's safe, and even some humans, there's been a phase two trial in Taiwan, showing the vaccine is safe and generates a strong immune response. And there's just a hint towards a 50% decline in moving towards cognitive impairment. So, and this is twice as effective as the current drugs for Alzheimer's disease. So they're talking about potentially, and this is what the trials are going to start pretty soon, 4 or 5 injections in the first year for people that have markers that they're on the way to Alzheimer's disease or early blood tests suggesting they're a candidate, and then maybe a booster once or twice a year after that. And we're talking about potentially this could happen by about 2030.
All right, Ross, thank you very much for your time again this Saturday morning. We appreciate it. I've got to let you go. I'm sure you've got plenty of things to do this afternoon. Look after yourself and have a good week, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Lovely to talk to you, mate. Thank you.